Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink. Political turmoil and a revolving door of governments in just a few years, including a new cabinet just this week, have created an atmosphere of chaos in Egypt. Through these first few months of 2014, a wave of terrorist attacks has hit the country, and protesters have flooded the streets, underlining a violent struggle between the military-backed government and a growing Islamist insurgency. This, combined with the mounting xenophobia fueled by government rhetoric, has made life difficult and very dangerous for reporters covering the events unfolding in Egypt, who risk being attacked by citizens and the government alike. This week, a trial began against three journalists from Al Jazeera English Network. They've been imprisoned for more than 2 months on charges of being members of and aiding a designated terrorist organization, the Muslim Brotherhood. Critics, including Al Jazeera, call the trial an attack on journalism itself. Our guests today on Global Journalist are witnessing firsthand the dangers of covering this conflict. Rana Alam is an Egyptian journalist and editor of Daily News Egypt. Abigail Hauslohner is Cairo bureau chief for The Washington Post and has been reporting in Egypt since the year 2009, first for Time magazine and then, of course, for The Washington Post as well. Thank you both for joining us today on Global Journalist. Appreciate you being with us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Jim.
So another new government is in place, at least for the moment. The world watches as the trial against those three Al Jazeera reporters began this week. The trial of ousted President Mohamed Morsi has once again been suspended as the court reviews the impartiality of one of its judges. And then the Egyptian interim government released results this week from an inquest into the deaths of hundreds of protesters, blaming those deaths on the Muslim Brotherhood. This is an ongoing conflict, obviously. And Rana Alam, you say this is just the latest of a long line, particularly of violence against journalists.
Yes, during the Mubarak regime, actually 10 years ago, it was in May 2005, we would never forget the Black Wednesday. It was the first time that female journalists were sexually assaulted while covering the elections back then. We had, since that day, we had a rising problem with assaults and arrests of journalists. In 2010, in the elections, there were 20 journals and bloggers arrested in the days before the parliamentary elections. CPG and HRW documented arrests and assaults and harassments. Several reports were issued at the time. So this has been going on in Egypt for a very long time. We're talking a decade. In 2008, five journalists were arrested, and one of them was an American reporter.
Abigail Hauslohner, being a Western journalist yourself, how do you approach your job outside of obviously being very careful about where you go and what you do in terms of being able to do it?
Well, as Rana said, the threat doesn't really distinguish between Western and local journalists. All journalists have had difficulty going about their jobs here, and it's been, I think, increasingly the atmosphere has gotten increasingly threatening to journalists since the coup last summer, in that Egypt has a new government that and an atmosphere that is sort of very dichotomous in terms of what's politically accepted and what's not, and that has fostered an atmosphere in which journalists who are critical, as well as activists and other people who are critical, are not as accepted as maybe they were before, not that they were ever particularly accepted. And that has increased the risk of arrest and harassment.
Are there pockets inside Cairo that are deemed perhaps safer than others? In other words, is this widespread, this concern about your personal safety, or is it just when you are in the thick of the action?
No, the danger changes right now are not really limited to certain geographic areas. It's that the danger is two-pronged. There's the threat of harassment or arrest from the state itself. And then there's also the threat of harassment and violence from ordinary citizens that can come from. And then this has often been, especially for foreign reporters, because there's, you know, a rising tide of xenophobia that you mentioned right now, that is in large part fostered by the state. But that puts foreigners in particular at risk during protests and riot situations.
And so what do you do to protect yourself? Do you travel in groups? What do you do?
Well, there isn't, you know, journalists have been covering conflict zones and war zones far worse than this one for hundreds of years. But it's not, you know, that we go about our jobs. We look at every situation. We look around us. We're observant. When things look like they're getting too dangerous, we leave because there's no story in the world that's worth getting injured for.
And Abigail, help put it in context. You were in you've been in other places, Iraq among them, yes.
Right. I've covered the wars in Iraq, in Libya, Gaza, Afghanistan, and also a bit of Sudan.
So put into context what you're dealing with on a day-to-day basis with those situations now.
Well, Egypt is very different from a war zone.
Sure.
In a war zone,
sure,
you're dealing with shelling and militaries and the threat of kidnapping. These aren't really concerns here. Here, again, you're dealing with a police state, a police state that where freedom of the press is not a reality, especially at this point in time. And you're dealing with a citizenry that's also often very hostile to the press, very mistrustful of the press. That's because they haven't had a very good experience with the press. Egypt does not have, Egypt has long been a police state, as Rana mentioned, and, it doesn't have a history of, an active free press, and especially a state press or private press that Egyptians feel like they can trust. They're used to being lied to by government newspapers and government television, and they're also used to being lied to by a number of private news organizations, too. And they're told that they're being lied to by the government, and the government is also very shadowy about what it does. And so there is a culture of conspiracy, and there's a tendency to mistrust journalists, which is all very understandable given what Egypt has been through at this point.
And Rana, since April, May 2011, certainly there has been an effort by many new journalists, new voices, to get into the game to sort of offer more perspectives, has there not?
Yes, of course. But unfortunately, almost everyone is biased. People try to get into the job to advocate for a certain cause and not for the sake of journalism itself and not for the sake of, providing people with news. And you always have this in every media publication that we have in this country. You need to know who does it belong to and what is their agenda, if any.
Help us to understand both the this week's developments in terms of the new prime minister being in place and also the upcoming April elections, Rana, and to sort of understand the role of the military chief and all of that.
Well, actually, I don't see a lot of change that happened in the government. You have the same Minister of Information in place. You have the same Minister of Interior in place. You have several infamous ministers who are still in place. And the new prime minister is a Mubarak person. So we're actually going backwards. We're not moving forward.
Sure. And in fact, 20 of the cabinet ministers remain. Nonetheless, the makeup of that cabinet and who was left out, omitted, at least says something about the state of the government, does it not?
Sorry, was that question to me or to Rana?
I think it's to Rana, but we're having a little bit of connectivity issues there. So can you pick that up there, Abigail, while we reestablish it?
Sure, sure. The cabinet is not, the cabinet reshuffle is actually, it's not to be given too much importance. Let's keep in mind that the president was appointed by the military following Morsi's ouster in July. And
right.
this cabinet was always a caretaker cabinet to begin with. It was an interim cabinet. It's widely viewed as one that was basically appointed by the military through the presidency. And so I don't think there are too many Egyptians who really batted an eye with this cabinet reshuffle, especially because Egypt does have a presidential election coming up in the next couple of months.
Right.
And the man who orchestrated the coup, that's the commander of the armed forces and also the defense minister, Field Marshal Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, is the person who everyone now expects to run for president and win. And so most people are really looking forward to that as the big political shift. And the cabinet reshuffle was not a huge deal.
And if al-Sisi does win, some of the things that I was reading was that this almost reverses most everything that then happened in the revolution of 2011. Is that a proper way of looking at that?
I'm not sure you can say it reverses it, because obviously Hosni Mubarak and his family are not going to be back in power.
Right.
But what it does do is it continues a long tradition of military regimes, military rulers. Here. Sisi, obviously, in the past 8 months has not given us any indication that he's pro-democratic reforms, pro-human rights, pro-freedom of the press. The government that most people here believe is largely under his control has locked up thousands of their political opponents. They've massacred nearly 1,000 others last August in breaking out protest camps. And they've also prosecuted journalists, including a major national news network, which is unprecedented here.
Sure.
So the chances of a democracy emerging from that are probably not good.
Rana, to what does Sisi owe his popularity with so many Egyptians then? And we still are having problems with connectivity. So maybe Abigail, you can pick that question up. To what do you think he owes so much popularity? Is it stability?
Well, Sisi is popular here in large part because the Egyptians feel like they had such a bad experience with Mohamed Morsi. That was the Muslim Brotherhood's candidate. He won the country's first democratic elections and ran this place for a year. The economy, which was in shambles after the revolution in 2011, never rehabilitated. Morsi did nothing to fix it. People were frustrated that he did nothing to reform key ministries like the police force, the interior ministry, for example. And he did nothing to fix the economy. The economy only worsened. And so there was actually huge popular support for his ouster. And that's why you have many military supporters here arguing that it was not a coup. It could not have been a coup if it was so popular. And so a lot of people see Sisi as a sort of savior. They are hoping, they saw that he was able to oust a very unpopular president, and they are hoping that because he commands the most powerful apparatus in Egypt, and that is the military, and because he commands his popularity, that he can somehow pull Egypt out of economic chaos and give people more hope, a better way to live, which is really the biggest thing that people here care about at this point.
Before we continue our discussion, I do want to remind everyone listening to this show that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcast at globaljournalist.org. There you can find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to the program. This week, we're going to talk about some of the other events that are surrounding this situation in Egypt. We also have an update on the situation in Ukraine. You can also follow us on Twitter at globaljourn.com, or you can visit our Facebook page at globaljournalist@kbia.org as well. All right, we're going to the popularity of Sisi, and to what you attribute that?
On top of everything Abigail said, which is all very true, there's also the fear. There's a fear-mongering, in the media. The military is making a point of making people very, very afraid of the return of Islamists and the terrorism thing. This is making people very, very afraid, and they all believe that the only way to stop terrorism is through a very, very tight security grip, which can only happen through the military. So this is very, very important when we think why people want Al-Sisi as president. They're afraid.
I'm very interested, Rana, with the rise of the xenophobia that we have discussed a little bit earlier here. The West seems to be in a very precarious situation, and conversely, it seems that Russia has seized on an opportunity. When the West canceled or at least delayed the $2 billion arms deal, it seemed to leave a vacuum for Vladimir Putin to step in. Is that the proper way of looking at that?
What again?
Is the West losing its any influence in how it is handling this situation, particularly the United States?
I'm not sure the West really had that much influence. I think it's being a little bit exaggerated when you think that the money given, the aid given to the military by the U.S. is more than doubled. Coming from the Gulf area, for example, you know, you have the Gulf supporting this regime. Billions and billions of dollars are being poured in this country through Saudi Arabia and the United Emirates. So, I mean, there's no money. You can't have influence through money alone. Not the Russians and not the Americans, you know, will influence Egyptian military through money, because that's already happening by the Gulf. There has to be some other way.
Sure. And speaking of stability, whether it be internal, whether it be economic, what allows some semblance of stability to return to Egypt? Is it in some sort of consistency? What do you see as being stabilizing factors that could emerge?
Nothing but a proper democracy. This country will not be stable unless we have a proper civil, secular, democratic regime. As long as we have the military governing us, or as long as we have the Islamists governing us, we will always be unstable. And this is something that everyone here at least needs to understand. The conflict now is not only between the Islamists and the military. There is the democratic side who are also in conflict. These people, these activists, are being jailed, and they're you know, behind bars. Most of them, our biggest high-profile activists, are behind bars. I'm talking about the democratic ones, and these are what we're counting on. It will never be stable as long as you have a high corruption in the country, as long as there's military rule, as long as it's a police state. There is, you know, there is no point in even imagining that we're going to be a stable country in the near future.
And Abigail, your take on that?
Rana makes a good point that it's unlikely, especially given Egypt's brief experience in democracy now, it's unlikely that people will settle down happily and accept another authoritarian regime. There is a growing opposition to the military government. While Sisi had a lot of popularity when he ousted Morsi, as Rana mentioned, he's earned more enemies since then than simply the Islamists. He's also earned opposition from a lot of liberal activists who are pro-democratic reforms but have been victimized by the new regime. And the economy is going to be key, too. If Sisi and the military do not come up with economic solutions, not just big ticket items such as, you know, big projects and stock market increases, which is sort of what we're starting to see now, but, you know, economic solutions that trickle down to the millions of Egyptians who live in poverty, we're going to see a lot more instability. People are going to get frustrated very quickly for the same reasons that they started to get frustrated with Morsi.
And what of the Islamists? Because as I read it, they were left out of this latest cabinet reshuffle altogether. So do they continue to go to more extreme measures?
Well, the Islamists are mostly in jail at this point.
Leadership.
Those who have experience. The Muslim Brotherhood leadership and many of their affiliates are in jail, or they've fled the country. So what is left of the Muslim Brotherhood is rank-and-file support that is largely, you know, not united, as far as we can tell, and that is continuing to stage sporadic protests. And then there are also more extreme sort of fringe elements who supported Morsi and are waging violent terrorist attacks on state targets like the military, like the police force. And a few weeks ago, there was an attack, first such attack in a long time, on tourists. So, you know, at this point, it's really unpredictable when most of that opposition and the political leadership from the Islamists has been locked up or killed. That leaves a lot of uncertainty in which direction that opposition movement could go. It leaves room for extremists to gather support and expand, and it leaves room for new leadership on the moderate side, but it doesn't look like the moderates are winning out a whole lot in this situation.
And Rana, that attack on the South Korean tourist bus that happened a couple of months ago that Abigail mentioned, it does further damage to the prospects of some sort of economic revival, at least coming from the tourism sector, does it not?
Absolutely, absolutely. You have the Germans pulling out every tourist they have in Sinai, and now Sharm el-Sheikh as well, which is supposed to be safe. South Sinai is now, you know, not safe as per all the tourist companies. So, yes, we're losing all the tourists in every area in this country because of this attack.
Help me to understand where you think that the trial of the three Al Jazeera journalists are going to go. And do you think that because there seems to be so much of a Western eye turned now to Egypt and to the atrocities against journalists, that somehow that might change anything in the outcome?
They're very, very unpredictable, Jim. Very unpredictable. You cannot tell. But I think they will release them eventually. I don't think they will be sentenced. But after, you know, after quite some time behind bars.
So what's
they will eventually release them, but you don't know, really.
So what's to be gained? Is there anything to be gained by the government outside of a chilling effect to journalists who might be poking their nose where they may not want them to be?
Just that is enough. Just that is enough. I had journalists trying to come to Egypt and work with the Daily News, and now they're not coming.
So
they changed their minds.
Sure.
So, yes.
And Abigail, obviously it doesn't dissuade you from going to hostile quarters and gathering the story. Does it change anything for you, or do you just continue on?
Well, the message that this sends is that the government is perfectly willing to go after major news organizations. This is the first time that we've really seen them do that. They're, as in, to take it to such great lengths, as in imprisoning foreign journalists for, you know, months at a time and putting them on trial. It sends the message that no one is really immune, and that the government can go after whoever it wants, that they can use whatever flimsy evidence they want, and that they can charge you with terrorism even though without any real indicator that you've been involved in terrorism. So I think a lot of journalists in both the local press and the foreign press are you know, significantly worried and disturbed, rightly disturbed by this whole incident. But I mean, the larger message, and I think the larger conflict involved in this trial is that this is a political issue between Egypt and Qatar, where the Al Jazeera channel is based, and Qatar had very close ties with Morsi, and that's largely what this is about. And unfortunately, these journalists are paying the price.
The images of those journalists in the cage, as it were, in the courtroom, certainly when you talk about a picture speaking more than 1,000 words of copy might be able to convey, certainly it does that, does it not?
Right. It was a very disturbing scene.
Rana?
Go ahead, Rana. Sorry.
Yes, absolutely. Of course. It was scary. Every one of us just watched that and of course was afraid. But then it wouldn't stop anyone. I mean, what are we going to do? We're going to continue our work, even though that could be the future of us.
Are you encouraged as journalists to see the campaign that was launched at the end of February, where on social media, you know, the tape over the mouth and the number of folks on social media who stood for both what you two are doing in your work, but also for journalism in general. Is that encouraging? Does that sort of help in all of this?
Of course it is. But again, I need to remind you that it is frustrating to see that only the Jazeera journalists are getting this kind of attention. This is quite frustrating. Again, there are dozens of people, of Egyptian journalists behind bars right now. And the only call is to free AGE journalists.
What else?
All journalists. This is frustrating, very much so, I'm sorry to say.
What else could Western governments, such as the United States government, do to assist or aid in that?
Just keep pushing. Just keep pushing, keep publicizing, keep speaking about it, keep issuing reports. This is the only kind of pressure I see that might work. Nothing else. Not the money and not the political ties and not the diplomatic approach. I think pushing is the way to go, through reports and through publicizing this problem.
And Abigail, do you get a sense that that resonates in the United States with public opinion, and that a public opinion might rise to the point of trying to pressure the United States government into doing more?
Yeah, I think, as Rana mentioned before, there isn't a whole lot the United States government can do here. It does not have a whole lot of sway at this point. The Egyptian government is not a big fan of the U.S. government, and it does not, as far as we can tell, does not appear to listen to them a whole lot. It's questionable how much influence the United States can have. I mean, there are actually, ignoring the Al Jazeera journalists for a moment, there are American citizens who are in prison here. They are dual nationals.
Mm-hmm.
There's one dual national named Mohammed Sultan. He's an Egyptian-American. He has both passports, but he's grown up in America. He went to Ohio State University, and he's been in prison in Egypt since August with a badly injured arm and has been denied medical access. The United States Embassy has been able to do almost nothing for him. They've tried, but they do not have a whole lot of sway with his government.
And it doesn't paint a very hopeful picture at all. Real quickly, with just a couple of minutes left here, what comes next in Egypt, both for journalists and for the country at large? Rana?
More of the same, Jim. More of the same. More political trials, more freedom, down on the freedom of speech, more of everything until the instability reaches a point where people will rise up again.
Abigail?
Likewise, it's very hard to tell what comes next. I've stopped making predictions. I've been here since 2009. I didn't actually see the 2011 uprising coming at all. Even the day before, I didn't think it would happen. So I'm probably not the best person to make predictions. It's sort of day by day where I'm consistently at least surprised by what happens in Egypt.
Why we cover the news rather than try to make it, right? Thank you both so much for your time. We've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist, produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. I was joined today by Abigail Hausloner of The Washington Post, also Rana Alam from Daily News Egypt. Mikkel Christensen was our executive producer of this week's show. Joanne Coca was this week's lead producer. Travis McMillan is our director, and Pat Akers is our audio director. Please join us again next week for another edition of Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink.